From Pittsburgh to State College, Harrisburg to Greensburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, the Cato Institute has published its latest Freedom in the 50 States report, and Pennsylvania did significantly better than surrounding states. Jason Sorens joins us with details. There is a correlation between job growth and passenger counts at Greater Pittsburgh International Airport. Eric Montardi and Jake Houck have an Allegheny Institute report. And despite false marketing from the Biden administration, government overspending and wasteful spending is driving the continued high rate of inflation. Emily Green explains on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Jason Sorens and the Freedom in 50 States report in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Most attention is focused on the presidential race, but voters in Penns Woods will be electing three statewide constitutional or row officers in 2024, and candidates are lining up for the jobs. Auditor General Timothy DeFore, who in 2020 became the first Republican to win that post in more than 20 years, has announced he will run for re-election next year. DeFore also is the first African-American to win statewide office in the Commonwealth. State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta of Philadelphia is the only Democrat so far to announce his candidacy for the position. Meanwhile, the race for Attorney General is getting more crowded. That seat will be open as incumbent Attorney General Michelle Henry, who was appointed to the job after Josh Shapiro resigned to become governor, is not seeking election. Two Republicans have joined York County District Attorney David Sunday in seeking their party's nod. State Representative Craig Williams and former Delaware County District Attorney Kat Copeland announced their candidacies this past week. So far, five Democrats have announced their candidacy for the position. Meanwhile, the effort to impeach Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner continues to slowly work its way through the courts. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court this past week heard oral argument as to whether they or lawmakers can remove an official from office. The Pennsylvania State House of Representatives has voted to impeach Krasner, but a Senate trial has been on hold for over a year as court arguments proceed. Krasner's soft-on-crime policies are being blamed for an historic spike in violent crime in the city of brotherly love. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania is usually near the bottom of any study comparing us to the other 49 states, but Penns Woods did remarkably well in the latest Freedom in the 50 States study released by the Cato Institute. Joining us is report co-author Jason Sorens. He is an economist at the American Institute for Economic Research. Jason, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Jason, before we get into the specific details of the report and which states did well, which states did not, particularly Pennsylvania, tell us a bit about the history of the report and the methodology that you used to develop it.
So we wanted to measure government respect for individual freedom in the most objective and scientific way possible. So we looked at a whole range of state policies, over 230 ways that state and local governments affect your freedom, whether it's your budget through taxation and government spending, or your business through regulation or your property rights, or your personal life. And we then combined all these policies by looking at the research on their effects and how valuable these freedoms are to people, and then came up with an overall freedom score. So there are three categories that we put our policies in. There's fiscal policy, that's taxing and spending, regulatory policy, having to do with business and property rights, and then personal freedom. And so when we add those all up, then we come up with that overall freedom score.
And I understand that as you develop this year's report, you use some new metrics?
That's right. We're always adding new metrics based on new things that states are doing and new technologies like vaping and ride-sharing services, as well as things that our readers recommend.
Let us also drill down a little bit more into each of these areas in terms of how they are used to compile this report here, Jason. Let's talk a bit about fiscal freedom. What all goes into that particular aspect of the report?
So there we're looking at your state tax burden, your local tax burden, government consumption. That's basically what the government spends on its own operations. And we also look at government debt, the financial assets that it has to count against that debt, and government employment, so how much the workforce it employs.
And under regulatory policy, what metrics do you use there?
We look at the most important one is land use and energy freedom. So that has to do with zoning regulations, and that's where a lot of our new metrics are, including state laws that kind of sometimes preempt local zoning regulations to allow a property owner to build housing. We also include things like renewable energy regulations there. We have labor laws like minimum wages and right to work laws, health insurance regulations, utility regulations, occupational licensing, so requirements that you need to meet in order simply to practice a trade. We also look at the quality of the court system and how it handles torts and civil suits. So that gives you a sense of the range of things we consider there.
And of course, personal freedom sounds like that might be a little more difficult to quantify. How do you do that?
That's right. So the most important category there has to do with criminal justice policies. So we look at where enforcement priorities lie in terms of so-called victimless crimes versus more serious crimes that have victims, for instance, drug offenses and prostitution and things like that. Then we also look at civil asset forfeiture, which you could also think of as a property rights issue where law enforcement can seize your property and auction it off, sometimes without even accusing you of having committed a crime. So we look at the rules surrounding that. We look at gun rights, gambling laws, education freedom, marijuana policies, smoking and tobacco policies. So that kind of gives you a flavor of some of the things we're looking at there.
Let's take a look now, just the 50,000 foot up in the air look of all the 50 states combined. Did you see any particular trend that has developed over the past year that would push us more toward freedom or further away from it?
Yeah, so there are some nationwide trends. We are seeing that personal freedom in particular has been going up. States are tending to allow for more personal freedom, especially on the criminal justice side, on marijuana policies, before that on same-sex civil unions and marriages. So that's a trend where the overall trend has been upward for personal freedom. Then with fiscal policy and regulation, it's more of a mixed bag. So there we've seen that over the last 15 years, states have generally improved on fiscal policy. So most states responded to the Great Recession back in 2008-2009 by cutting spending more than raising taxes. And so that left them with a good sort of fiscal legacy for the following decade. We have seen, though, since the start of the pandemic, that a lot of the revenue sources that states have used have ended up taking a bigger bite out of people's paychecks. So the overall kind of tax burden has risen a bit over the last 3 years. Then on regulatory policy, the trend has not been so favorable. In part, it's due to the federal government, actually. The federal government has stepped in most notably on health insurance and taken over an area that states used to regulate. And they've done so in a way that significantly increased the role of government through so-called Obamacare. So that's been a big decrease in freedom on the regulatory policy dimension. But there are other ways that the federal government has gotten involved to encourage occupational licensing and things like that. So overall, I would say that the average regulatory burden that businesses face from state and local government has gone up over the last decade.
We are talking with Jason Sorens of the American Institute for Economic Research about a report of which he is co-author, Freedom in the 50 States, published by the Cato Institute. So now, Jason, let's talk a little bit about the horse race, if you will. Which states came out on top when it came to freedom, and who was lagging down at the bottom?
New Hampshire and Florida were number one and two in our report, and that's very similar to what another report on the Economic Freedom of North America has found, so no surprise there. But we also see that Nevada, South Dakota, and Arizona are very high in our top five. And then at the bottom, we have New York, which has been no surprise. They've been last place in all 23 years included in our study, going all the way back to the year 2000. And California, Hawaii, New Jersey, and Oregon are also in the bottom five.
Sort of the usual suspects there. Pennsylvania oftentimes is in the bottom of these types of reports and surveys. So tell us a little bit about Penn's Woods here. How did we fare?
Well, Pennsylvania did okay. Pennsylvania is number 18. And that really has mostly to do with fiscal policy. And there it's really Pennsylvania kind of footprint of government. So in terms of government consumption, what the government is spending as a share of the economy on its own operations, for instance, wages and equipment, and government employment. In those areas, Pennsylvania is very low in the sense of very small government. So that raises Pennsylvania's score. And the tax burden in Pennsylvania is about average, but more of it than the average state is at the local level, which means you may have a little bit more choice of your tax burden, depending on where you live within Pennsylvania. So for those reasons, Pennsylvania is actually a top 10 state on fiscal policy for us, but then it's below average on both regulation and personal freedom.
Interesting that Pennsylvania would be above average in anything. And I guess congratulations to us. That's a change from the norm. How did we fare relative? We know New York, of course, was at the bottom. How about the other states contiguous to Pennsylvania? How did we fare relative to those states?
Well, Pennsylvania is actually better than all of the surrounding states. Ohio's not too far below Pennsylvania. But this might help explain why Pennsylvania has done better than, say, New York and Maryland in terms of economic outcomes. We find that personal income growth relates to economic freedom, the fiscal and regulatory parts of our index. And we find that personal freedom, in addition to economic freedom, attracts new residents from other states. So Pennsylvania has done reasonably well by those measures. During the pandemic, it's had slightly higher than average economic growth, and it's been kind of static in terms of people moving in and out of the state, which is a lot better than the surrounding states, especially New York, where well over 10% of its population has left.
Over the past couple of decades here, Jason, we've had a number of jolts to our economy, be it the September 11th terrorist attacks, the economic meltdown of 2008, 2009, and of course, the COVID-19 pandemic. How have all of these crises affected your report in freedom in the 50 states?
Yeah, I think they've affected the political environment, and they've affected certainly the role that the federal government has played, which influences the states. So the federal government has sent a gusher of money to state and local governments since the pandemic, and states and localities haven't even been able to spend all of it. But what we have seen is that they haven't taken the opportunity there to really cut taxes in response to this new money. They've just spent that new money, and maybe that was the intention. But what it does mean is that in general, when we see that the federal government gets more involved, sends money to states and localities, it generally doesn't reduce your state and local tax burden. It simply raises your federal tax burden, your long-term federal tax burden, because they have to get that money from somewhere. So we even see this at the local level when state governments send money to local governments to pay for schools, for example. That generally doesn't end up offsetting local property taxes in the long run. It just adds to your overall tax burden. So one of the recommendations we would make, kind of witnessing the trend over the past 20 years or so, is that higher-level governments should let lower-level governments basically stand on their own resources, you know, spend out of their own revenues, because then they have an incentive to be fiscally responsible. But again, in terms of some of these big changes that we've seen, on balance, you might have expected that something like the Great Recession would grow government. But what we find is that that the financial crisis and the economic dislocations associated with that ended up making state governments more fiscally responsible.
Jason Sorens is an economist with the American Institute for Economic Research, co-author of the report Freedom in the 50 States, published by the Cato Institute. Jason, tell us a little bit about the American Institute for Economic Research and Cato, and also where can folks go online to read Freedom in the 50 States?
Yeah, so the American Institute for Economic Research at AIER.org focuses on research in three areas: economics and economic freedom, monetary policy, and collectivism, fighting collectivism. So this is an area where we're looking at the new kind of threats to economic freedom that are out there, not just coming from the left and support for redistribution, but also coming from the right and support for economic nationalism and industrial policy. And we are very happy to work with the Cato Institute on this study. We think it's definitely closely related to both of our missions, looking at personal and economic freedom. And you can find out more about this study at freedominthe50states.org. That's freedominthe50states.org.
Jason Sorens. Jason, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
Job growth in southwestern Pennsylvania is lagging, and so too is the rebound in passenger counts at the Greater Pittsburgh International Airport. Here to discuss the latest numbers and the relationship between the two are Eric Montardi and Dr. Jake Hauck with an Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is President Emeritus of the Allegheny Institute, Jake Hauck. Jake, you recently wrote a brief that is available at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, about the relationship of Pittsburgh metropolitan area jobs and the performance at Pittsburgh International Airport. Could you give our listeners an idea of what the long-term trend at passengers at Pittsburgh International Airport has looked like?
Eric, I'm happy to do that. The Pittsburgh International Airport has suffered a pretty dismal last 20 so years. You know, back in the early part of this century, the major carrier there, U.S. Airways, underwent bankruptcy and finally was sold out to American Airlines. At the time, in 2001, Pittsburgh was the 23rd ranked airport in terms of passenger getting on at the airport and flying out or landing back in. Over the next few years, they fell from 23rd to 32nd by 2004, and then their decline has just continued almost steadily, and now they're down to 49th largest airport in terms of passengers boarding and deplaning. That's a long-term slide. It's had major ramifications for the airport. Nonetheless, as you might get to in a moment, they are building a new passenger terminal in hopes of stimulating travel, and they're also subsidizing international flights pretty heavily. In the August data, which was the latest we had when we wrote this last brief, the emplanements at the airport had not reached back to the 2018 levels. And that's fascinating because at the same time, job levels in the Pittsburgh area, private sector jobs, were still below the August 2018 level. So there is a fairly tight connection, I think, between the long-term and the short-term performance of jobs in the region and the number of passengers using the airport.
Jake, can you give our listeners an idea of what the most recent data on passenger counts at Pittsburgh International look like?
The FAA data, which is the federal administration that takes care of this passenger data by airport, show that in 2022, the Pitts passengers remain significantly below the 2007 as well as the 2019 levels. In fact, they were nearly 90% below the levels recorded early in the century. Thus far in 2023, total passengers have improved relative to 22, but in August of 23, they still were below the levels recorded in August of 2018. Probably more importantly, despite the well-publicized efforts to boost international travel at Pitt by using carrier subsidies, the August 23 international passenger total of 18,500 was 55% below the August 2018 count and 28% below the level recorded in 2019. So the conclusion that we're coming to is that absent some stronger performance in the local economy, it's unlikely that the airport is ever going to see the kind of numbers they were posting back in the early part of the century. And that's notwithstanding this effort to subsidize international travel as well as to build a new terminal. I don't think the new terminal is going to matter very much in terms of attracting people to go to the airport. The population here is pretty stagnant. The jobs are stagnant. And you need both in terms of income and population growth to grow the number of people trying to fly or wanting to fly.
Jake, let's talk about that second point there with the regional economy. Can you give our listeners an idea of what the latest data on private sector jobs in the Pittsburgh metro area show?
Well, very similar to the passenger data, the job count is actually still lower in August of 2023 than it was in August of 2018. And that's a very poor showing when you look at the national recovery, even the Pennsylvania numbers. Across the state, we have metro areas that are showing some decent job growth. But for some reason, Pittsburgh region just has not been able to get any real traction in growth of private sector jobs. And that due in part to a lot of reasons, but one of the things we found over the past couple of years is there's a close connection between job growth in a region or in a state, in fact, that ties closely to the presence of public sector unions and the lack of right to work. If you look at Dallas, for example, that Metroplex down there has added 900,000 jobs since 2000, which is almost as many jobs as there are in Pittsburgh in the seven-county region. And that's pretty remarkable. That's a 50% gain in that part of the world. And we've only had a 3% gain over 20 years in the Pittsburgh region. We definitely have to move away from the policies that are destructive of job growth. I mean, we have some sectors that are doing okay, but overall, it's not a good picture for the region as a whole in terms of jobs.
In conclusion, what effect, if any, will this new terminal have on flights and jobs?
Well, that's an interesting question, but I don't see how changing the structure of the airport terminal or its amenities is going to affect passenger demand. I mean, the reason people fly is they want to go somewhere. And you could have a terminal facility that was detracting or not attractive to passengers. It might keep some from coming. But I don't think the reason people are not coming to the airport is because of the terminal. We had that same terminal back in 2001 when nearly 20 million people flew in and out of there. So it's not the facility so much as it is the, as long as it can handle the capacity, it's the demand, and you need demand for any business, for any service. You have to have people who want to pay for it. And if you don't have population or job growth, you don't have the kind of base of demand that will grow enough to grow your passenger demand.
Jake, great stuff, and thank you very much for sharing that with our listeners. Please visit our website at www.AlleghenyInstitute.org. This has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
The left would have you believe that corporate greed is responsible for the rapidly rising cost of living. But the real culprits are government overspending and government wasteful spending. So says Emily Green of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary.
Washington politicians will point fingers in every direction before looking in the mirror and realizing that, yes, their special interest spending sprees have led to record high costs associated with everyday life. This year, we've seen officials who have spent decades of their career making paychecks off the taxpayer turn to false marketing tactics to sell those same taxpayers a bad bill of goods. First, we were sold Biden's Bidenomics, or what the 46th president claims would help turn our post-COVID economy around through, you guessed it, more spending. Though this was marketed as a, quote, bottom-up and middle-out approach to economics, with, quote, competition at the forefront of his plan, Bidenomics manifested as more wasteful spending, with only certain industries and businesses receiving special favor from the administration's spending spree. Now, in November, as Thanksgiving rapidly approached, and subsequently, so did concern around the increased costs associated with Thanksgiving dinners across the Commonwealth, Senator Bob Casey spun his own false narrative and released his, quote, report on greedflation. According to Senator Casey, this report shows the impact of prices on consumers due to corporations raising the prices of goods and services, quote, because they think they can get away with it. In his report, Senator Bob Casey outlines the general idea that, quote, from July 2020 through July 2022, inflation rose by 14%, but corporate profits rose by 75% over those 2 years, five times as fast as inflation. He continues, corporations raised prices on consumers not to offset inflation, but to increase their own profits. While on paper these numbers might look right, Senator Casey's calculations are missing an incredible amount of context. What Casey's report fails to take into consideration is, quote, taxes, inflation, changes in inventory valuation, and depreciation, according to Americans for Prosperity's own senior fellow, Kurt Couchman. Kurt argues that once these factors are considered, overall corporate profits have, quote, barely moved since pre-COVID rates. Instead, rising prices are simply a result of Washington's spending problem. As Kurt eloquently shared, these increased goods can be explained by basic economics. Quote, widespread consensus that inflation comes from too much money chasing too few goods. It's no secret that the people of Pennsylvania are hurting. When surveyed about the issue that would most likely drive a likely voter to vote in the 2024 election cycle, over 66% or two-thirds of voters cite the economy and inflation. Of course, Senator Casey is concerned about spinning the narrative to deflect blame for his wasteful spending habits. We can work towards a better economy, one that allows for a market-driven approach to fighting inflation, as opposed to throwing money at a problem to solve for it. Pennsylvanians are smart, and they know that catchy marketing such as, quote, Bidenomics or, quote, greedflation is simply a tool to deflect from Washington's failed policy. Let's do better, Pennsylvania. Join our movement for more and our pathway towards a more prosperous Pennsylvania by heading to prosperityispossible.com, signing your name to our petition, and sending a message directly to Senator Casey's inbox that you reject false marketing and you want to see this economy get turned around. Again, you can head to prosperityispossible.com, sign your name to our petition, and hold your senator accountable. This is Emily Green, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 28 years now, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WWBE-FM and WFYY-FM in Selins Grove, along with WBHV-AM in Somerset, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.